The storm in the nation's Capitol building by Trump supporters saw many images, but one stood out. And holding a Confederate flag as he marched through the halls of Congress. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. There are many trappings of white nationalism, including a noose just outside the building. White supremacy has a long history reaching back from Jim Crow to the Confederacy. And it has deep roots in our country. We turn now to Catherine Barrett Gaines, Associate Professor of History at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. She specializes in African American history. We have her on the phone this morning. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Don. Thanks a lot.
So let me ask you this. First of all, when you saw the storming of the building, obviously we all were a bit appalled by it all. But what struck you about it, particularly the kinds of signs and the kinds of things that we saw people carrying?
Well, I mean, my eyes saw the same thing we all saw. We were shocked to see I guess half of the country was shocked to see the Confederate flag. We were mystified by some of these other bizarre-looking flags that you had to Google and figure out what they meant. I was not shocked to see this "Do not tread on me" flag. Don't tread on me flag. That's been a long Confederate flag light for a long time. That's kind of acceptable in well-heeled neighborhoods, but you know what they're trying to say. But the other half of the country was probably, and of course the Trump flags right alongside of all those flags were obvious markers that all this stuff is one. But then I guess the other half of the country wasn't shocked at all and was very excited about it.
How do you identify this or tie this to what we seem to be seeing as a rise of white nationalism or white supremacy, as it were, given some of the symbols that we saw?
The word rise is interesting. I'm not sure how much of it it's rising as in increasing. I think what we know is that all of this stuff has given permission to be more loud and proud in the past 4 years. But I'm not sure it's increasing. I don't have any evidence of that. I wouldn't say it because I just don't know. And I hate to say things that that I don't know. But there are people who study these things who would know more if it's increasing. But it certainly is more visible than it has been in my lifetime or in any time that I've studied.
Go ahead.
Outside of the 350 years of enslavement in this country, where it was just an obvious policy.
So, well, take us back a bit, because the country was founded and we had colonies which saw the import of slaves. Tell us a little bit about that history, and one particular event, of course, is the Bacon Rebellion.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people talk about things like that, and I like to look at law. I think Peter Wood is a historian at Duke University. He wrote this really great book called Africans, Colonial America, A Strange New World, and he sort of pinpointed the beginning, kind of the beginnings of white supremacy. They go back to like the middle of the 1600s. As you said, the country wasn't even founded, right? It was a place where millions of people lived here, and then some other people came from the America, from Europe, and from Africa, not as enslaved people, as various forms of servants and various forms of colonial kind of scouts to see what kind of money could be made for places like England. And then, you know, the people were sort of living together doing all the same work because it was just a lot of work. It was a hard place to work. And everybody was doing kind of the same work, all colors of people, all religions. Was doing, you know, cutting down trees, basically, and pulling the stumps out, which is really the main work of the Americas, of the North America. And then we start to see interesting shifts in law. And I think that's the place where we see the beginnings of white supremacy. Like, for instance, in 1664, a law is passed in Maryland. And that's what's interesting. Maryland is sort of the motherland of white supremacy. 1664, Maryland passed a law that where Christian baptism would not affect a status of a slave. It used to be that you could only enslave people who were of a different religion than you. Muslims wouldn't enslave Muslims. Christians would not enslave Christians. And then African-American people picked up on that and started converting to Christianity in huge numbers so that they wouldn't have to be slaves. And Maryland quickly could have stopped to that and passed a law where Christianity wouldn't have anything to do with being a slave. You could be a Christian slave as early as 1664. Now, this is a big thing, right? Because this is clearly a purposeful effort to keep black people in slavery, right? And that's a new thing, which was attaching blackness, Africanness, African-Americanness to slavery. Now, that sounds obvious to us, but you have to see that the things that are obvious to us today have not always existed, right? So we look in history to find out, well, where did it start? Well, that's where it started. And then eventually all these different laws come into play in the 1600s in Maryland and in Virginia, where the word black, or the word Negro they used to use, and slave become interchangeable words. And then we have laws in the later in the 1600s and 1700s where, for the first time in human history, slavery becomes hereditary and perpetual. Now, we're used to that in America because we grew up with that, that when you were born a slave, you died a slave, and your kids were slaves, born and died slaves. Now, this has never been done in human history before. Human history has never seen people born into slavery and dying into slavery and passing on their status to their children. We invented that here. And so that is really the birth of it, right, where the word black becomes, or the word Negro, or whatever word people are using, becomes equivalent to the word slave. And then, therefore, the word white becomes a marker of people. Before these laws, Don, people were either Christian or pagan or Muslim. They were either French or German or Spanish or African. They were not slaves. They were not black and white. So we here in America invent the idea of blackness, and we invent the idea of whiteness, and we gave birth then to this idea that there's something wrong with being black and there's something fantastic about being white. That's the birth of it. So when you find these disaffected, you know, out of work white people in America, the reason they're so upset about it is because for 400 years the expectation is that whiteness is great. It's fantastic. It's perfect. It's best. It's the best thing you could be. And there's no reason that any black person should be in a better situation than a white person. It's just not the American way, and it hasn't been for 400 years. That's where the anger, that's where the white rage is. No black person should be doing better than me. I'm white.
Well,
it starts back in 1664.
Well, in those terms, because one of the things in about reading, being particularly about slavery, is that prior to the Civil War, there were many whites who did not own slaves, but nonetheless saw themselves benefiting from it.
Sure. And their whiteness. Whiteness was what you needed. And, for instance, okay, Fannie Lou Hamer. So during this period of slavery, Fannie Lou Hamer is a great example, another that has this great event in her life which helps us understand. So Fannie Lou Hamer is a activist in the 60s, right? But she was born into a sharecropping family, one of 20 kids out in the Mississippi. And, you know, as you know, sharecropping was just another version of slavery, in some ways even worse. And so it really was a continuation of that. So she's living with her 20 siblings and her parents in a sharecropping cabin in Mississippi, Ruleville, Mississippi. It's basically slavery. But this is a woman who died in 1977. This stuff is not that long ago. And her father, you know, the rules of sharecropping are that you get to live here on my plantation, and then you get to work, and you get to do all this work, and then I get half of what you yield, and you have to pay me for the seeds and the tools. And by the end of the year, guess what? You're going to be in debt slavery to me, and you're never going to leave. Well, if somehow Fannie Lou Hamer's father pulled them out, like he was able to make enough money and collect enough cash to buy his own land and his own animals. Well, that so enraged his neighbors, who also had nothing. His white neighbors were so enraged, they poisoned his animals and sent him back into sharecropping. That's the whiteness that we're talking about. These are not rich people. These are not slave owners. It wasn't his plantation owner that did this. It was the enraged white people nearby who saw him getting better, doing better than them. It's not about, like, I need to keep you on chains in my plantation. It's that no white person should be doing worse than their black neighbor.
I want to turn, by the way, to Thomas Jefferson for a moment, because on the one hand, he writes about the all men are created equal and almost embeds, as it were, this concept of equality. While at the same time, of course, he certainly did not view Africans or black people as equal, matter of fact, as inferior. We had a naturalization law, I guess, of 1790, which said that all white persons had citizenship.
Right.
That there's this contradiction that seems to exist in our society. Right. On the one hand, these people not only owned slaves, but certainly viewed black people as being inferior. And yet, on the other hand, they embedded us with this tool, I guess it was, of this concept of equality.
Right. Yeah, you know, it's interesting, and we can look at Lincoln the same way. You know, Frederick Douglass had a great speech during the Civil War. He made this speech in New York where he talked about, you know, the Lincoln administration just being so weak and ineffectual, and the Emancipation Proclamation is just not being good enough. And because Lincoln said, you know, I'll take the country united over freeing people. And so, we look back at these heroes, you know, that we have big buildings about of, you know, Lincoln and Jefferson, and we forget that they didn't have any conception of equality. They didn't have any conception that people were the same. They were born also into white supremacist society, and they were white supremacists. And, you know, Jefferson was a very wealthy man, and Lincoln was a very poor man, but they were both white. And so whiteness is something that is just part of being white. And I think the biggest challenge for all of us is, even though those of us maybe who are listening to public radio right now and we feel good about ourselves and we're liberal white people or progressive or whatever you want to call yourself, it's up to us to kind of really examine how we're complicit in this. You know, Martin Luther King had a great speech. Well, it was a speech. He wrote his letter from Birmingham jail while he was under arrest in Birmingham, and he takes to task in that letter the white liberal. He said, I'm more disappointed in the white liberal than I am in the Southern segregationist, because silence and doing nothing or saying wait or slow down is hurting me more than the KKK or the white councilman. So I think we all, you know, and those of you, people who are listening to Don Rush, of course, and people who are taking my courses probably feel really good about ourselves because, you know, we're not in the KKK and, you know, we're not waving any of those kind of flags we saw on January 6th. But we are complicit. White people are complicit in many, many ways in this system because it's a 400-year-old system, and it's hard not to be. It's almost impossible not to be. So I think that's our big challenge, right, is not to feel so excited because we're not outly racist. I think we've got to really look deeper into this system that we're all part of.
Well, one of the things that strikes me is, particularly at this moment in time, we're looking at a decline in terms of white people as being defined as white, I guess, in terms of the portion of the population. I think it's by 2040 or 2050, whites will dip below that 50% mark. In 1980, for example, the electorate was 85% white when Reagan was elected. This year, it's down to low 60s, and it will continue to drop. And one of the things that strikes me about the reaction we're seeing, whether it's the assault on the Capitol or other symbols, is this coming realization that the society is changing in a dramatically different way. I mean, and you see this also, you know, in television programs and so on. I mean, the media, much more diverse than certainly when I was growing up in the 1960s, as an example. I mean, it seems to me that there is a recognition that there's a day of reckoning coming here, particularly for white supremacy or white nationalism.
Yeah, it's so funny. When I look at, and it could, you know, some television commercials might be regional, but when I watch, it seems like every major car manufacturer, the advertisements have always put, it seems like they almost agreed to never promote, never put a family in a car that's where every member of the family is the same color. You know, it's pretty cool. It's like all the, you know, you notice that? Like every major car manufacturer has a multiracial family in the car. It's kind of amazing. But I wonder if those things are regional. I wonder if you know, people in the South are seeing the same pictures, the same families we are. But I think that we have to also be careful about the idea that just because a society becomes a minority white society doesn't mean it doesn't remain a white supremacist society. You know, South Africa famously did that, and so did South Carolina and Mississippi. I mean, every state in the South, every colony and then state in the South was a white minority colony. You know, Peter Wood, the guy I referenced earlier, wrote this fantastic history of South Carolina called Black Majority. South Carolina has always had a black majority in Mississippi and Alabama. So there are many, many ways to exert white supremacy of over a majority black population. In fact, that's the key. That's the reason for white supremacy, is to subjugate a larger population than who's white. You don't need white supremacy when white people are the majority. That's why, you know, white supremacy is born in slave situations. You know, we have to reckon with the fact that 350 years of our history has been under a system of slavery, and that only just ended. You know, I had a student come into my office one time, and she just looked at me bewildered, and she goes, why do people not understand this stuff wasn't that long ago? It wasn't that long ago. You know, I mean, it just wasn't that long ago. And then after, say, let's assume slavery comes legally to an end in 1865, it's not till 1965 that we see voting rights begin to be extended to people who were of the descent of people formerly enslaved. And I was born in 65. You know what I mean? So, like, this stuff wasn't that long ago. And as we see as a result of January 6th, it hasn't gone anywhere. It hasn't gone anywhere. I mean, you could say voter suppression is worse now. Attempts to are worse now than ever. So, I mean, as you say, you know, we are with people like Stacey Abrams and projects everywhere. But the fact that we have to continually send people into neighborhoods and into communities to get people to vote or try to get people to vote is a continual war on voting. And, of course, that was the origin of the KKK, right? I mean, we think of the KKK as people who, quote, hate black people. That's pretty much the assumption my students make. But when you look at trials and you look at transcripts and you look at their efforts, what they were is an army devoted to keeping black people from voting the wrong way. So KKK didn't hate black people. They didn't hate black people who voted for, in those days, Republicans, right? So that was what the KKK was dedicated to, was eradicating the 14th Amendment, which is why the federal government went after them. And so we think of the KKK as white supremacists, let me stamp out black people, but they actually, white supremacists love black people in certain positions in society. It's when they get out of those positions that things get ugly and terrorism starts. They have to exert their terrorism. So terrorism works for a minority of people. So I don't know about this just because of the changing nature of the demographic that we're going to see white supremacy narrow. I think if history shows us, we're going to see it increase.
Well, I mean, certainly if you begin to lose power in certain effects, whether it's in elections or what have you, you're certainly going to get the pushback. I mean, one of the things that struck me, and it was pointed out to me actually by somebody who was studying education, is that there, in the South, there was an authoritarian quality, not only obviously during slavery, but post-slavery, which utilized things like keeping blacks from the voting booth, keeping them in certain trades, and so on. And I'm just wondering whether or not the kind of description of authoritarianism that's been, say, thrown to describe, say, former President Trump, or even some of the actions by the Republican Party in terms of trying to restrict voting, whether there's a continuation, there's a connection there between the two, someone doesn't really believe in democracy so much as an authoritarian way to stay in control.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're absolutely right, Don, that white supremacy is the antithesis of democracy, and it is much more aligned with authoritarianism because it's all basically based on, you know, dad, right? The big white father, he will make sure you're okay. It's paternalism. It's all those things that were slavery, that were Jim Crow, that were, you know, that were Donald Trump and everything in between, that it's democracy is the enemy of white supremacy. That's the KKK. The KKK is the opposite of the anti-democratic police, the anti-democratic war. So, yeah, there's no democracy would solve all our problems. We just haven't gotten there yet. You know, but I you just have to look at the Senate. to see that the demographic of the Senate, that is the authoritarian white male. And remember, there's a gendered aspect to this, too. It's not just authoritarian. It's also paternal. It's also masculinist, right? Which is why I think that all these, like this Marjorie Taylor Greene, she's not going to get anywhere except clickbait, because white supremacists are never going to follow a woman. Now, you know, I've just made a definitive statement that's a prediction of the future, which is historians never do, right?
Right.
But it's just not going to be. Now, she notices how she has to outman the men, right? She's got to carry guns, and she's got to talk dirty, and she's got to use profanity. That's the only way to get men to pay attention to a white supremacist woman, which is why, you know, Sarah Palin had to carry a gun on her hip and while she's wearing a bikini, right? Because otherwise, white supremacist men are just going to dismiss you, right? So it is a male thing. It's an authoritarian thing. It's all part of this patriarchal, paternal, authoritarian, white. It's all aspects of the same animal. And that, I mean, look at the Senate. Don, how many women are in the Senate? How many non-white men are in the Senate? But this is 2021. Now, when we see the Senate changing color, if I see the Senate changing to reflect the demographic of America, that's when I know we've got democracy. But right now, it's the House of Lords, and that House of Lords doesn't look like it's going anywhere. They have a lock on how to get elected.
Well, I mean, it does seem to me that the Madisonian view of a republic where minorities gain some kind of power in order not to be overrun by majorities, which was his great fear, that we're now at a situation where a minority, in this particular case, and what we're talking about is, say, white supremacy or white population, will continue to control the lever of the power because the fact that they constructed this thing as such that it would not have necessarily an instant response to a majority, as it were.
Right. Yes. Yeah, and it's funny because President Obama drew attention to that in a post-presidential speech when he talked about the Senate being a foundation pillar of white supremacy. Yeah, it's interesting, right? We think of the Senate as being part of our democracy, but it, in some ways, it's kind of a way to ensure that there's not too much democracy, right? Democracy can only get so far. Democracy can get into the House of Representatives, but it really can't get into the Senate. You know, the Senate can put a stop to everything.
Let me see, you're a teacher. How do you see racism being taught about to students? I mean, you see students coming through. Obviously, you keep track of what's going on in the education field. What do you see in terms of that being taught or how students perceive racism in this country?
I think it's certainly the key, and it's just not happening. I think someone told me that in Howard County, Maryland, they have been told to not, and we have students who are now teachers, you know, and they tell me, they were told to not reference January 6th. So, you know, public school is having a tough time, I think. I think it maybe depends on the school you go to and the teacher that you have, but we certainly have a very short memory in America, and Sherilyn Eiffel wrote this great book about this, the last lynching on the Eastern Shore, and she called for truth and reconciliation. You know, this is the Princess Anne lynching in 1946, and she said, if you don't have a truth part, there's no reconciliation. And this has become sort of obvious and more talked about lately, but she said that way back, you know, 20 years ago or 15 or when she wrote this book. And this is what we don't do in our education system. We just don't tell the truth, and here's why. Because the truth is horrifying, you know? And I always tell my students, college students, I'm like, I can teach you this stuff now or have you read about this stuff now, but when you were in third grade, you couldn't have read about this. You'd have gone home crying. You know, American history is so horrifying that we can't teach it to children. And that is the truth. It's so horrifying, we cannot teach it to children. And so we can only teach them fantastical stories about heroes. And even black heroes, right? We can only teach them the fantastical stories about the black heroes. But, you know, when you even in Black History Month, you tend to just teach these horrifying stories of violence toward black people, which makes the black students cringe and feel terrible and makes the white students feel guilty. I mean, we just haven't gotten it together because we just refuse to accept. We all cannot agree on the history, right? We have alternative facts. We have alternative stories that we teach depending on the demographic of the room.
How do you see the two sides, particularly for students, how do you see the two sides trying to overcome the very obstacles that you talk about? On the one hand, it's the brutality, certainly recognized by African-American students. On the other hand, white students not wanting to feel guilty. I mean, it really generates, I think, a real difficult divide. You know what I mean? For reconciliation.
At HBCU, most of the students are black.
Right,
but
of course.
I've had a white student at HBCU, my University of Northern Shore, a white student came to me and she said, I was going to take your class, but I don't want to because I think people in the class will blame me, will look at me and blame me. And I just looked at her and I said, well, then you have no idea how teaching works. So I guess if people are bad teachers, that would happen. We can't blame the teachers because they have the books that are in front of them and the curriculum and the way they've been taught. I mean, it's just, we just don't tell the truth. And then, of course, we have a national project for 400 years of making sure white people feel good and okay. And that, if we continue to do that, we will never face up to the white supremacy that all of us are carrying around and all of us are contributing to. We just don't allow white people to be uncomfortable. It's just not part of being American.
One of the things that struck me, and then we did some stories on the lynchings that were here, the last lynchings that were done here, and one of the things that was pointed out to me is that there were a number of people who did not want to talk about them because their relatives or their predecessors, right, and were involved. Sure. I mean, it seems as if, particularly for small communities, whether it's Somerset or whether it's here in Salisbury, that it's that particularly is just too close for many people.
Yeah, absolutely, Don, because this stuff wasn't that long ago. I mean, even January 6th, you can look around your own family and friends and find maybe they weren't there, but they were happy about it. I mean, we look in our own households, look at our own children, our own brothers and sisters, and we are related to. We are cooking for white supremacists every day, and maybe we are white supremacists. You know, I think that we have to start in the mirror. We have to start in the mirror and then look to our immediate family and then further out. But, yeah, no, it's us.
Is there a difference, and I've thought about this myself because I'm white here, is the idea that perhaps one shouldn't, if you're white, is not – The reaction should not be guilt, but rather recognition.
Right. Yeah.
And there is a difference between those two.
Sure. Yeah. Guilt is a useless feeling, right? There's no point in that. And of course, guilt is your own creation. Human beings create their own sense of guilt. No one gives you a sense of guilt, right? You create it for yourself. So if you're feeling guilty, check and see why. Right? I mean, if you're feeling guilty, there's an issue, right? But if it's just understanding, see, it's not about guilt. It's about let's understand this. Let's understand what happened, and then let's understand what's happening as a result of what happened, right? And because, as you know, as Faulkner said, especially in the South, history is not the past. History is happening now, right? Everything that we are and do is because of what happened before. It didn't end. Nothing ends. It just continues on in this form. So we have to recognize that. So no, guilt is useless. There's no point in that. But we got to understand it, and then we have to figure out how to make the system better. We have to figure out how to make systems better, more equitable.
Catherine Barrett-Gaines, she's Associate Professor of History at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore, specializes in African American history. We appreciate you taking the time to talk to us.
Thanks, Don. I always appreciate the subjects you're interested in. I think you're a great asset to the Eastern Shore.
Thank you. This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.